Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat Cold Tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500. Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
Today's cool fact of the day is that the velocity of a sneeze is around 100 miles an hour. And when you sneeze, it can actually travel up to 5 feet, which is kind of gross. But sneezing is your way of keeping your nose clean, and usually it comes from dust or some other thing, sometimes even a strong immune response that causes your mucous membranes to be irritated. And it's true. It's impossible to sneeze with your eyes open, and you can't sneeze when you're asleep. And if you do sneeze, it'll change your heart rate variability, but your heart won't stop functioning when you sneeze, even though urban legends say that's true.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount.
We have a great interview today with Andrew Tillin, the author of a book called The Doper Next Door. Andrew talks about his experience with performance-enhancing drugs during a competitive season of bike racing. We talk about the pros and cons of his experiment, and we try to educate people on the use of steroids.
Now we're going to move on to our exclusive interview with Andrew Tillin.
In the name of science, Andrew Tillin became a citizen doper. In 2008, this freelance writer and amateur cyclist used supplemental testosterone and DHEA to improve his cycling performance. He chronicled his journey in his book called The Doper Next Door. Andrew has written for many publications, including the New York Times, Wired, GQ, Rolling Stone, Yoga Journal, and Runner's World. He was also a senior editor for Business 2.0 and is a contributing editor for Outside magazine. He joins us today to talk about his experience with doping, the dangers, the perks, and how it changed his life. Andrew, tell us, what prompted you to experiment with steroids in the first place?
I like to think of it, Dave, as a social experiment, really a social experiment in seeking and finding youth. And that's not necessarily how it started, but that's ultimately what happened. And it became a social experiment, not just for myself, but for my family, friends, and a larger circle of people.
So do you mind if I ask, how old are you now, and how old were you when you started your social experiment?
Yeah, I'm 46 now. So I was 42 when it began, and it began both as an interest in sort of feeling young again, and it also began as a long-time journalist following athletics, following elite athletes, seeing what they could do, and knowing that there was a lot of doping going on, and wondering, what would it be like for a regular guy to do this kind of thing? What would it be like for a face in the crowd, so to speak, to take these drugs? And do other people do that? And then I was a bike racer, a road racer at the time, and I would go to these races, and I'd be convinced that there were others doing it. And I went through a long process of actually trying to find a citizen doper, quote unquote, to write about. I wanted to write a story, a magazine story, or a book about someone's experiences doing this kind of thing. And so that was a long process, maybe 6-7 months of really hard looking before, for various reasons, I decided to become the lab rat myself.
I wish we'd known each other back then. I've been taking supplemental testosterone for the last decade, except for the last 2 months, because people say that that my gains come from that, not from the diet. So I quit doing it just to show that the diet works by itself. But we would have had a good time chatting back then.
Yeah. Well, were you a bike racer too?
I was a bike racer before that, but I was too busy being an entrepreneur to be a successful racer. I'm intrigued to go further into our discussion. Can you tell our listeners which performance-enhancing drugs or hormones you used, just so they can sort of get an idea of the scope of your experiment?
Sure. I used testosterone. That was the big hitter. And, of course, that is a taboo drug to many red-blooded males. We know all about testosterone from what we hear on ESPN or reading Sports Illustrated or reading the sports pages, because it's a prohibited substance, because it promotes the growth of muscle tissue, essentially, to simplify. And it was easy for me to access. That was also important. Hence the name of the book, The Doper Next Door. I took another hormone, 2-DHEA, another prohibited substance in many sports, and I took that sort of to prime the pump for testosterone, or so I was told by my hormone guru. And I took only those two drugs because that's what was suggested to me. And I also only took those drugs because I wanted to prove a point with this book, and that is how easy it is to access, particularly testosterone. Middle-aged guys nowadays, all they need to do is watch golf on television to see giant pharmaceutical companies advertise for supplemental testosterone and to promote testosterone supplementation. They just need to go to their doctor. Well, not just, but they go to their doctor and have a frank conversation about maybe how they're feeling, have blood work done, a highly interpreted read of their testosterone levels follows, and then they may or may not be given supplemental testosterone. So that's why I stuck with those two. And the other reason I stuck with those two, Dave, was to sort of go further up the ladder in terms of performance-enhancing drugs, human growth hormone, erythropoietin, or blood enhancers. I would have had to go to a black market, so to speak. I would have had to buy those drugs illicitly. My doctor wouldn't prescribe me those drugs. And that wasn't within sort of the spirit of the book, which is how every man can, quote-unquote, be a quote-unquote doper.
So you skipped modafinil and Adderall, or commonly known as meth, which certainly on the meth side of things would have been a good idea to skip.
I'd be talking out of school to talk about things I don't know about those drugs.
Okay, so you skipped those ones. So you focused on performance-enhancing hormones, which is important. Now, you mentioned that it was relatively easy to find testosterone. And what form did you take it in, and where did you get it? Like, how hard was this?
Yeah. So I began, really this whole experiment began with my wife. My wife was, she's about my age, and she was going through some early hormonal changes, and I would notice these hormonal changes quite often, either in her mood or her libido or lack thereof, or the fact that she'd wake up in the middle of the night with night sweats. And she ultimately went to a women's health doctor, was given hormone replacement therapy, and I saw that these hormones had very powerful, created powerful changes in her body. I was impressed and sort of wowed, and just did some internet surfing on that and discovered that many middle-aged men were being prescribed testosterone too, and there were lots of websites speaking to this. And so I went to my doctor and I said, well, do I need this stuff? And this is my primary care physician, and she, and I had blood work done, and my blood work showed that, indicated that I was quite low within a quote-unquote normal range, but very low within this normal range. And so my doctor, my primary care physician said, no, you don't need it. But I wasn't satisfied. I mean, at that point, I'm a journalist. I was curious. I'd read a lot about it. I read about a lot of people taking it. Testosterone is a $1 billion supplement industry. Millions of prescriptions are written for testosterone every year. And so I went to a couple other doctors and got, including my urologist. My urologist wanted to put me on a modest amount of testosterone. Again, I'm a journalist. I wanted to tell sort of the biggest and most compelling story I could within the realms of taking this drug. And so I embarked on a little mission to talk to doctors in the anti-aging community. And anti-aging is sort of an offshoot of medicine, so to speak. Some people would think that it's mere quackery. Other people would say, no, you know, there is some legitimacy to anti-aging medicine, which doesn't want that these people, and they are physicians and some of them are not, they don't want you to live forever. They want your quality of life to be as high as it can be, as long as it can be. And they believe that testosterone has a place there. And I ended up going to a couple of anti-aging doctors. One scared me because he was willing to give me testosterone without really monitoring my blood levels very closely. But then another woman was very thorough and looked at my same blood levels that my primary care physician had looked at and said, you should be on this. And she worked with a woman by the name of Susie Wiley. Has a protocol called the Wiley Protocol, both for women and for men. And the one for men is a testosterone protocol, and it is very aggressive. It's very high levels of testosterone. And again, in the spirit of telling a great story, I started on this protocol, and it was a topical, cream-based. I would put it on my groin and on my back between the DHEA and the testosterone, twice a day. The T twice, as I came to call testosterone, the T twice a day, DHEA once.
That's it's kind of funny. We actually had Wiley on a very early incarnation of the show.
And, yeah, what was that like?
You know, she's an interesting lady. She's certainly has a very strong opinion, and I've met her in person. She actually gave me a copy of her book, Sex, Lives, and Menopause, at an anti-aging show. I didn't mention this at the beginning of the show, but I've run an anti-aging nonprofit, like education research group for, good God, I've been involved in leadership there for almost 10 years. So a lot of what I do it comes from anti-aging, and I hang out with a lot of the same kind of doctors you're talking about there. And,
okay.
And you hit it right in the head. It's about living more and living longer, not living forever, which is an important thing a lot of people don't understand.
Yeah, that's an important distinction, and that actually, to me, lends to, you know, the credibility of that industry. And it also, you know, that industry asks a lot of questions that the traditional medical industry can't answer or is sort of unwilling to go to. And, you know, there's a lot of profit built into the traditional medical industry and big pharmaceutical industry anymore. And so that's the part that I find highly compelling about the anti-aging world. You know, the problem is that there's still some questionable characters promoting things that you just you don't know about, and that they, frankly, they don't know about. And Susie herself will be the first to tell you that she is a citizen scientist. Now, does that mean that we shouldn't listen to her because she's not a PhD, you know, or an MD? The answer is, I don't know. She is very charismatic and passionate, and her arguments are well-scripted.
And her books, too, are one-third of the length as usually references. I would not want to get into an argument with her about, you know, hormones are bad for you in all cases, because I absolutely know that you'd lose.
Well, she came to one of my readings in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I was reading from this book, and my book is both supportive and critical of Susie. And she was I honored the way that she approached the discussion, and the way that, you know, the debate we had afterwards and the dialogue. And, you know, at the end of the day, Susie just does not understand why in God's name any middle-aged man, you know, who's low on testosterone would not be on it. So it's like 2 + 2 = 5 in that equation for her if you're not on it. So that's her perspective.
Andrew, we've talked a little bit about some of the problems with finding practitioners who know what they're talking about. What were some of the biggest challenges you faced throughout your entire experiment?
Well, one was that, you know, that was the start. And I finally found an internist with many, many years experience as an MD. And that, again, that doesn't necessarily legitimize someone or delegitimize someone, but I felt like she had a broad perspective and she had balanced thinking. She was very forthcoming with me in terms of saying, you're a guinea pig. This is, you know, you're part of a large experiment. I'm going to watch you carefully. I'm going to monitor your blood levels 4 times a year. And it was about a year-long experiment. And I'm going to, you know, tell you to go higher or lower, or I'm going to be a critic. I'm not just going to be a cheerleader saying, take more. Or she had a raised eyebrow while still prescribing it to me, which I thought was very healthy. And, you know, I pushed her to give me human growth hormone because I wanted to try that. And she was like, you're out of your mind. I won't do it. Not enough science there. I could lose my license for prescribing it to you. I could get in a lot of trouble. And you don't need it. And I honored her for that. I thought that was reassuring. It was disappointing in a certain way, but, you know, reassuring, and also reassuring for my health. I didn't want to hurt myself doing this experiment. And the growth hormone science is not complete. Other than that, my other concerns, I have a family, I have a wife, I have children, and I worried about, or I wondered, part of going back to what I call the social experiment, what was life going to be like? Taking this stuff and having a family around, and the, sort of the opening of the book is both sort of funny and dark. I'm in my bathroom putting on the testosterone for the first time, and I'm nervous, you know, and my kids are on the other side of the door just banging on it because we're going to be late for school, and I'm taking them to school. And I sort of asked myself, did Jose Canseco have moments like this? And I wondered, too, you know, I mean, what was this stuff going to do to me? Was it going to make me stronger, faster, more masculine, more macho? Was it going to make me a jerk? Was it going to make me scary? Was it going to make me sick? Was it going to change my relationships? And I would say that, you know, the year that followed hit on a bunch of those notes. I'd be interested to know, Dave, how much testosterone you took and how you took it.
I took it in a cream form. It's a bioidentical form of testosterone that's compounded for me. I took about 10, I'm blanking on whether it's micrograms, milligrams, a day.
Something grams. Something small.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I'm not thinking of it right now. But, yeah, I did that for almost 10 years. I measured the blood levels a couple times a year after the first year. And it, for me, it had really positive mental effects as well as physical effects. But keep in mind, I was obese for the first half of my life. I used to weigh 300 pounds. I weigh 200 pounds now. And because of that, my estrogen levels were very high and my testosterone was, you know, pretty much at old man level, even though I was only 30. So there was a therapeutic reason. It is quite a tale, but part of the tale is that, you know, I've been off of it for a while, and throughout those 10 years, I've gone off for a couple of months here and there just to see what would happen. And pretty much I'm able to self-sustain without it, and I'm going to go off of it for at least 6 months now and look at the effects of just the Bulletproof diet, which is itself very testosterone-friendly, and look at what you can do nutritionally. And I'm almost 40. I just turned 39 earlier this year. So I'm getting older, but I'm kind of, you know, seeing what happens without the testosterone just because I think I can. But I don't think there's anything wrong with taking it. I think it helped me enormously.
Well, you were certainly in a sort of a different place in your life than I was with mine. I mean, you know, I was already, I'm a little guy. I don't carry a lot of extra body weight. I'm just built small. And, you know, 5'8", 145 pounds. And so, and I was fit, and I was adding this to sort of the regimen. And so it had,
you're the perfect cyclist frame. How did this affect your performance actually? You know, what did it do to your times or your heart rate, or how did you measure your performance on this?
Yeah. So I think, let's be clear here. I'm a journalist. I'm not a scientist. I'm one guy. This is not any sort of scientific experiment. This is an unscientific guy next door experiment. And so I had what's called a power meter for my bicycle. A power meter is an elaborate electronic device that actually measures the power that your legs push into each pedal stroke as you pedal a bicycle. And it's a very scientific way to measure your performance. And I say that not to sort of toot my own horn, but to say that that's how power meters are basically the ways that virtually every pro cyclist use to improve upon their performance, right? Their coaches and support staffs hook their bikes up to power meters. And so I had one of those, and my power went up dramatically over the course of that year, right? These numbers won't mean anything just sort of floating around, but from 260 watts I could hold, I went up to 310 watts. Now, I will tell you that I also trained harder, and I trained harder for a couple of reasons, one being the passion. I mean, it just became more and more fun, because what the testosterone really helped me with, and scientists will argue, but this was my experience, was it was a recovery drug for me. It allowed my body to snap back more quickly from hard workouts. And what that enables you to do, of course, is to work out harder more often. And then it just snowballs. The harder you can work out and the more often you can do it, and the faster your body recovers, well, the fitter you're going to get. So the testosterone, will any performance-enhancing drug turn anybody into a world-caliber athlete? The answer is no. You have to add training to the mix. But so many of these drugs will actually help you recover, which will help you to train. So that was, you know, the most scientific approach to, or the most scientific aspect was that. And of course, I also had my blood measured and my testosterone measured within my blood. And I went from the high 200s in terms of testosterone content in my blood. And it's a unit of measure, to, I believe it was nearly 800. And that is at the high end of normal. I still was in the normal spectrum. In fact, Susie Wiley ultimately wanted to give me more testosterone, but I felt like I had plenty going on because I had all sorts of other feelings. But in terms of my performance, it was that ability to recover. And I went to races, and I raced, and I knew I was breaking the rules. That was part of the experiment, too, for myself, for my own head, for my friends, for my fellow racers. What's it like to race either as or with a doper? And, you know, I did better in my race. So I'm not a great bike racer. I'm on sort of at the entry level end, a cat four, as you would say. I'm not a cat two or cat one, but I felt like that helped me in terms of the book, because I wasn't sort of, at the end of the day, I wasn't racing anybody to, as a livelihood. This was, we were racing for fun and bragging rights and, you know, maybe a new tire or, case of power bars. You don't race at that level to make a living. But I did better in those races, and I would dictate in those races. I felt like I had a lot of power late in those races, and I would sort of break apart the group and force people to ride fast to keep up with me. I wasn't smart or good enough to win, fortunate or unfortunately, but I tried.
It sounds, I mean, you got an increase in performance, an increase in recovery, and an increase in passion. It sounds like this was good for you. What was the downside here?
Well, there was a lot that's good. I mean, you know, in terms of sheer black and white, one downside was, of course, that I was breaking rules, right? Right or wrong, that a 40-something man should be racing against 20-somethings, and I did race against 20-somethings in some of my races because the way the category sort of shook out and the races shook out, I would be racing against guys almost half my age. You know, I don't think it's necessarily fair that a 40-year-old has to race against 20-somethings, but those are the rules, and I wasn't playing by them. So one downside was I broke rules, and I ultimately paid for it in terms of being suspended from bike racing for 2 years, being banned from the sport, and all my results being erased from my year of doping. But beyond that, my relationships were challenged because, you know, there's a term called roid rage, which the medical community does not embrace, does not believe exists. But there are some experts, hormone experts, who believe that an excess of testosterone might prime the pump in someone who is irritable, someone who's prickly, and I can be prickly, and I would get short. You know, I had arguments with my wife and my children. My children were too young to really know what was going on. They were, during the experiment, they were in the 8 and 6 range. So, you know, I kind of felt like they were victims at times of my short fuse and my anger. And it never got to the point where I was tearing apart my home or throwing things or anything like that. But I did get to the point where I was having, you know, bad arguments with my wife, and she was saying, "This is not the person I know." And that sort of coupled with the fact that Wiley had me on very high amounts of testosterone, much higher than yours, Dave. And when I was on the, and it was cyclical, it wasn't a consistent amount over the course of each month. And in the deepest and highest parts of the cycles, when I was taking the most, I seemed to be the most sort of prickly. And I would say the other challenge was that, like you, mine was a topical, but I was using gobs of it, and I had to be very careful in terms of not getting it on towels or sheets or clothing that I might rub onto members of the family. I worried about my children. There are some isolated cases reported to the U.S. government about what's called virilization, which is when kids are exposed to hormones, testosterone, and their bodies develop prematurely. It's just a bad thing. You know, I didn't want my 8-year-old sprouting pubic hair, and there are documented cases of that. So I had to be careful. In fact, a strong argument can be made that my testosterone did rub off on my wife, and her levels went through the roof. And her women's health doctor at one point was like, "You're on your way to becoming a man. You guys got to be more careful."
Well, so I don't want to cross into two personal areas here, but there are actually, I know some of the followers of my blog, some women who occasionally have used testosterone for its performance-enhancing benefits, more for quality of life. We're talking relatively small amounts, maybe even less than your wife got, but they've generally reported that in very small doses that their passion at work, their sex drive, and just like their energy throughout the day skyrockets without, you know, growing a mustache. Did you see any of that in your relationship, or was it mostly a negative effect on your wife as well?
Dude, there were many positives.
Okay, that's what we're talking about. I sleep in the same bed as my wife.
Yeah, and it just was, her levels just got very high, you know, and so I was concerned, and it was, although Susie Wiley argues otherwise, and you know, and I state that in the book, that Wiley didn't believe that my cream was rubbing off on her, but my doctor, sort of the intermediary between me and Wiley, definitely was concerned about what's called contamination. And so, yeah, Wiley prescribes testosterone, or doesn't prescribe, she's not an MD. She suggests that women go through a doctor and perhaps in their midlife take some testosterone, like your listeners, people taking small amounts for added libido, perhaps, you know, aggressiveness is not the right word, but maybe added assertiveness, maybe stronger in their convictions. And I was all those things too. And you know, there was that funny, blurry line between what was sort of considered a little too aggro on my part and what was considered swagger and fun and assertiveness. My libido shot through the roof. I mean, to the point where I would catch myself looking at women in ways that I hadn't done since I was a teenager. And it was all at once sort of like highly entertaining, a lot of fun, and supremely obnoxious. And so, you know, it was kind of like, wow, who am I now? You know, but that spilled over into my relationship with my wife, and that was largely a good thing. And combine that with her sort of being contaminated and her drives and swagger going up, and yeah, there were fireworks that were really, really fun, you know. And again, that line is weird and blurry and inconsistent between, well, when does the fun, you know, stop, and sort of the questioning of this stuff begin? And you know, I don't know, I never found that line during the year of the experiment. By the time her testosterone had shot through the roof, it was pretty much time for me to get off the testosterone, that is.
So you stopped it entirely, and to this day, you're not using even small doses, right?
I am clean for, that's probably not the word you like to use, but it's the word that the doping cops really like for me to use, because I'm a sanctioned athlete, and I can, is that the right term? I am, they can come in whenever they want. The U.S. Anti-Doping Agency knows where I am, theoretically, every minute of every day, and they have the right to walk into wherever I am, cup in hand, and make me pee into it. And if they find exogenous testosterone in that in my urine, and it's easy for them to find, I will be likely banned for life from bike racing.
So as long as you race, this is not an option for you.
As long as I race or I want to race, it's not an option. And, you know, that goes back to Wiley and her, the disconnect that she sort of encounters between, or she believes exists between, a middle-aged man who wants to be virile and athletic, and here's this hormone sort of waiting for him, you know, to put his levels back up to what they were when he was a younger man. Versus the rule book, which says you can't do that. I mean, and I understand both sides of the equation. It's a slippery slope for the doping agency. If they let, you know, a middle-aged man who says, well, look, my levels are low, if they let that guy take the tee, suddenly the floodgates are open. And, you know, I will remind you and your listeners that even while, you know, pharmaceutical companies can prescribe and do prescribe testosterone, and for many cases they prescribe it for men that are, you know, very low or estrogen dominant, or, you know, in a way where it's a no-brainer. But for gray areas, people like me, you know, who is normal low, there's no proof long term that this is safe. Right? There's no proof that it's enormously detrimental, but there have been long-term studies using testosterone halted because of side effects, you know, potential cardiac events, as one study addressed, but that was for 70-year-old men, not in great health. Well, how does that translate for a 40-something guy who wants to take it? The answer is nobody knows. Those studies have not been done. And so, you know, that was another reason I stopped. What are the long-term health effects of me taking this drug as a guy who's, you know, sort of low, kind of low, interpretively low, but not
lower than low?
And I don't know that I wanted to take that chance. So, yes, I am not on the T right now, even though I miss it.
So you do miss it. That was actually going to be my next question for you. If there wasn't the cycling prohibition, would you still be taking some of it now?
The answer is a big fat maybe. You know, I would have to debate it. I would have to decide in what form to take it. Times when I think the best way to do it is with a syringe. You know, you don't have to worry about contamination. You don't have to worry about rubbing the stuff on. It's a little bit more uneven, apparently, in terms of its effect, because you get this giant injection of it. There's no sort of time release, or it's not absorbed in any sort of gradual fashion. It's suddenly, you know, hello, bloodstream. But I know people that use a syringe to take their testosterone, and I have done it for years that way and are happy about it. But, you know, there'd be nagging questions that I would have about these long-term effects. And really, Dave, the bigger question here that I pose in the book is, what am I chasing? I'm not saying that I'm not chasing the right thing in wanting to be younger and youthful and feel more virile, but maybe God, or if you don't believe in God, some higher being or some evolutionary decree has been put down where aging is maybe part of the process of living. And, you know, that doesn't float so well with the anti-aging community. They say be all you can be, but maybe being less than you can be is maybe part of having a perspective on life. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there.
That's incredibly perceptive, and it's definitely a debate in the anti-aging community. I've definitely angered a few people by looking them straight in the eye and saying everyone dies, and you know the universe will come to an end at some point, and you'll die then if you haven't done before. So, you know, we all know it's there, but the idea of fighting against death to me isn't that interesting anymore versus, you know, making the most of every minute that I have before I die, recognizing that it's going to happen. It's a little bit more of a holistic Buddhist kind of thing mixed in with the anti-aging thing. But believing you're going to die makes it so that your life is a little bit more precious. And that actually may drive you to choose to be more virile or choose to be more powerful in your life, maybe even through the use of testosterone, which is that weird conundrum, right?
That's right. Or, I mean, the flip side of that is you may choose to have a different experience later in your life, and that may be about being less in your body and more in your head and in your conscience. And it may not matter to you that there were some really interesting moments when I decided to go off the stuff and to never, you know, I mean, to really go away from it. First off, I failed a couple of times in trying to go off it because I didn't want to. But in some of those moments, I looked at myself in the mirror and thought, well, I'm never going to be sort of, and I wasn't buff, but I'll never be this powerful again. And it's a weird feeling to consciously know that you're not going to be as, you know, the physical specimen you are at that very moment ever again, because unless you perhaps go back on these drugs. But again, you know, who's to say that what it is that satisfies us and brings us happiness and wisdom and a feeling of fullness as we grow older? For some people, it may absolutely be feeling strong in their bodies and sort of sound in the mind in a way that's been enhanced by something, some sort of additive supplement, synthetic. For other people, it may be like, you know what, I want to experience what this is like without that stuff. And, you know, I mean, you can draw that to an extreme. It's like, well, great. So, I mean, that's practically Christian Scientist, as in, well, you know, don't take anything then and just suffer through pain and you know, perhaps die an early death and blah, blah, blah. I'm not saying that. But I don't know. There might be insight had in growing older if you do it without this stuff. Maybe not. And the last thing I'll say on this point is, I'm still pretty darn fit and strong. I'm in my mid-40s. I may sing a completely different tune 10 or 15 years down the line. I may be like, serve it all up, buddy. I am missing life. You know, it's a 46-year-old perspective now. In 15 years, it might be completely different.
That's also a fair point. The members of the anti-aging group, which is called the Silicon Valley Health Institute, that I run, some of them are in their 80s. You know, they look like they're 60 and they're dating 40-year-olds. And I can definitely say that at more advanced years, the impact of things like this it's shocking and amazing when you have a proper anti-aging protocol that includes some of these. But you know, you're in that middle ground where, you know, you're not old and you're in good shape.
Right.
So it is a very tough line, and I respect the way you're thinking about this very much.
Well, I also think that, you know, I went to an anti-aging clinic in Las Vegas and sat down with the guys there and at Cenogenics. And I mean, they were pretty clear with me. They said, you are atypical. You know, you're atypical for somebody of your age, not even because of your age, but you come in, you're already, you know, in good shape. You're not overweight. Usually the people we get coming in are exhausted, you know, have aged way too early, carrying too much weight. And so, you know, they can be offered sort of a second lease on life that perhaps they didn't think was attainable now. In fairness to Cenogenics will also say, you got to improve your diet, you got to improve your sleep, you've got to improve your fitness. You know, it's holistic. And I think that the anti-aging industry is largely that anyway. It is holistic. It's not just sort of like, take these drugs and, you know, dial back the clock. It's much more along the lines of, take these drugs and be far more responsible for yourself. Right? I mean, wouldn't you agree?
Totally. In fact, one of my favorite anti-aging physicians, Dr. Miller in Los Altos, in Los Gatos, California, he looked at me one day and he said, Dave, the most impactful thing that I've been able to recommend in a long time is that people do these breathing exercises from a book called Meditation is Medicine. He said, I can recommend this, but you know, my patients are responsible, but I can't get them to do these things, and it really frustrates me. So, you know, the idea of a physician looking at hormones, nutrition, supplements, exercise, sleep, and then even meditation, and trying to put it all together into a program to make older people feel younger, it's definitely not what you get at your primary care physician, but I find it valuable, and I've seen it reverse the lives of older, very sick people, and it seems to work.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, where we live and have been trained to live in a society where, you know, the pills and the syringes and the shots and the lotions those are the answers. You know, we can abuse our bodies, but this stuff will save us. And we've sort of, I hate to use the word brainwashed, we've been heavily influenced in that thinking by the marketing of drugs in America. And so, you know, whatever people take, I still think that at the end of the day, and including what they take, you are responsible for you. And you are your best advocate, and you are your best critic. And whatever you use, you should be mindful of how you use it, and you should be mindful of the way you treat your body. Period. You know. It's funny. Susie Wiley will debate the idea that exercise and nutrition particularly exercise, maybe not so much nutrition. Exercise really, she sort of shrugs her shoulders at the ability of exercise to sort of make us feel young. But she's a big proponent of a lot of sleep, I'll tell you that.
It's really funny that big variables seem to be nutrition, sleep, and exercise. And it seems like you can achieve goals with almost any one of those three, or certainly by focusing on just one and finding a balance of those three that works for you. It is there. And we've had guys like Bill Andrews, an expert in telomeres, come on and talk about the telomere lengthening effects of what I would consider to be shockingly unhealthy amounts of cardio. There really are different axes to making that decision, and I'm not sure there's one right answer. I think it's an optimizing thing that you'll run your entire life. You'll optimize how you feel and perform if you're aware of how you feel and perform.
Anyway, we digress. Sorry.
We do.
Speaking of enhancing performance, what were the most profound changes you noticed before dope or after you started doping and after you finished it? And another question is, did you ever purposely push the limits of this experiment, maybe to make the book a little more exciting, since you are kind of writing the book as you go?
Yeah. I'm a small-framed guy, and I remained small-framed, of course, throughout the experiment. I did have bigger muscles, more definition. That was apparent. And then that ability to recover. So again, going back to, I would race against guys who I'd been racing against for years, and I'd be leaving them behind. I mean, that's a qualitative result, but it was pretty apparent to all of us that that some levers had been thrown inside of me. And after I got off it, I was banned from racing. Well, no, that's not true. I wasn't banned from racing for a long time afterwards because I didn't let the secret out. But after I got off it, it was winter. I stopped training. I stopped taking the stuff. I did have some weird hormonal effects coming off the drugs, and I was worried coming off the drugs that I would, that my hormones would go way out of whack, and then I would develop man boobs, which can happen. But Wiley had assured me that sort of the brew she'd concocted wouldn't allow that to happen as I went off, and it didn't. But I was, mildly depressed. And is that because of the hormones, or is that because the experiment was over? Is that the aforementioned I'll never be the man I was kind of thing? I think it was all those things that led to my sort of down disposition afterwards.
Yeah, did you ever maybe spice up what your activities in order to make the book a little more? Yeah,
well, I mean, I was on, like I say, radical amounts of testosterone at times. I mean, going from very little at one point in the month to more than, bodybuilders would use for a couple of days. That was just sort of the Wiley method. She believes that that not only women but men are on sort of a cycle hormonally, and that you should take different amounts of you should supplement your levels of hormones with different amounts as the month wears on. So I did not feel the need to sort of spice or spike the levels I was taking. And in fact, Wiley it's a big no-no on the Wiley protocol to stray radically from her proposed levels. And that's just her shtick. And I've heard her get, I've heard of her getting very upset with people for taking less or more than she recommends. And I was a little intimidated by her. And, my doctor said, you can stray a little bit, but not a lot. And so I felt, I felt like, there was about 10 months. I stopped taking it after 10 months. But there was 10 months of plenty of spice in my life. Sexually, physically, emotionally, I didn't feel the need to get kookier still. And really, I mean, I tried that in terms of finding growth hormone, and I don't know what your guys' feelings are about growth hormone, but again, my doctor wouldn't prescribe it to me, and I wasn't going to go elsewhere for it. I was afraid, again, to have, my best medical advisor be what I could find on the internet with drugs that I've gotten without medical help. And nobody had offered me growth hormone. You know, I went to several doctors, anti-aging doctors. None of them were outspoken in terms of offering me growth hormone. And EPO, which is this blood enhancer, is not something given to healthy people ever. And so for me to take that would have been a huge no-no, although it would have had a huge impact on my bike racing, because blood enhancers are things that allow your blood to become more concentrated with red blood cells. You mix those drugs with an oxygen-hungry sport like distance running or competitive cycling like the Tour de France, and you have huge improvements, but I wasn't going to go there.
That's an excellent segue to my next question. Speaking of the Tour de France, the most tested athlete probably in history, Lance Armstrong. There's a huge debate right now about whether or not he doped, and since you obviously have a pretty profound insight into this topic, do you think Lance doped?
The sport has been around for over 100 years. The sport of cycling, and particularly, you know, long, long races like the Tour de France, which go on for many, many, many days, have that race is over 100 years old. That race began as a media event. That race began when newspapermen wanted to figure out ways to sell newspapers on the other side of France all throughout the summer. And so they created this race called the Tour de France, which would go all around the country. And it was a circus event. And the people that raced in it were victims and guinea pigs as much as they were athletes. And, you know, back in the early 1900s, nobody cared what these guys took in order to race the race, right? The newspapers got what they wanted. They got to report on this race happening all over the country. And people bought newspapers to keep up with it and to find out what the other end of the country was like. Let's be mindful that the early 1900s, there were no planes. There weren't a lot of cars. People didn't know what life was like on the other side of their own country. And so this race sort of would unite people and give them an eye onto not only the racers, but their countryside. And these guys took everything. They took whatever they could find. They smoked cigarettes. They took nitroglycerin, cocaine, amphetamines, heroin, strychnine. These were the early years of the Tour de France, and the race grew up, and the sport grew up, and the sophistication in drugs grew up with it. And I find it really hard to believe, no matter, you know, what any 2, 3, 4, 7 people tell me they're trying to do in terms of cleaning up cycling, that these drugs are not an enormous part of the sport. It doesn't mean I don't know Lance Armstrong. I have no idea at the end of the day. But I will tell you that he participated in a sport that has a long, institutionalized track record of performance-enhancing drugs. And the drugs have only gotten better. and the mice, and those would be the athletes and the teams that manage these athletes, have only become smarter in terms of avoiding the cats, and that would be the cops, in terms of being caught or not being caught. Recently the guy who heads WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, said that the very low percentage of people being busted for taking these drugs isn't because there are so few drugs in sport. It's because they're so bad at detecting them. This is the guy who runs the World Anti-Doping Agency. So for me to hear Lance Armstrong say that he's been tested over and over and over again means very little in terms of whether or not he's taken these drugs. I hope I've done something to answer your question. Sorry, it was a very long answer to a very quick question.
You showed a lot of thinking about the problem in general there. And as a citizen scientist, as someone who's interested in pushing my own capabilities there, I look at Formula One racing. And the technologies that are out there in those cars over the course of 10 years make it into the cars we drive, which make them safer and faster and more efficient. And part of me looks at things like competitive sports, and I just saying, I wish I just had a list of what all those guys were doing, because we know some of them are doing things they're not supposed to do. If we just opened up the training journals and the experiments that they're running, I feel like we would learn things about the way the human body works that no one knows because it's all secret. At the same time, there's the argument that, you know, athletes would kill themselves, and in surveys they actually admit they would, to be top of their field. So I don't know how to optimize the answer to that, but man, I want the data.
Well, I would agree, and I would disagree with you that all the time trickle down happens in terms of what professional athletes have used and what amateur athletes enjoy from both an equipment standpoint, right? I mean, we can ride the same bikes that the Tour de France racers went on, to the aerodynamic helmets they use in time trials, the power bar was invented by elite distance runners. Gatorade was invented for elite football players. Over and over again, every day, I should say every year, we enjoy more that enjoying more of the technology that elite athletes enjoyed, down to their coaching and the aforementioned power meters that I was talking about. Those that, 20 years ago, power meters were utterly exotic items, and the idea of training with them was not well known. But now, $500 will buy you a power meter, and $100 will buy you $100 a month will buy you a coach who can tell you exactly how to tailor your workouts to best work with those devices. And so I would say that we constantly enjoy trickle down from elite athletics. But I would also agree with you, Dave, that where's this all headed? Because I think that we want to emulate our heroes in all ways. And I think that is right down to the drugs they take, right down to the testosterone that they use, and perhaps the other drugs too, although T is the most accessible, effective performance enhancing drug to my mind. You might know more and you might beg to differ, but, I would argue and worry about the idea of how far do we take this, because you're right. Athletes have proven before that they will take whatever it takes to win, even if it kills them, and we've seen it happen. They've died in bike races. They've died on basketball courts. They've died in plenty of places unexpectedly, and perhaps because of what's inside of them.
Most definitely. Well, I don't think we're going to get to the optimal solution here on the show today, but we do have time for the last question that we ask of all of the guests on the show, and that's based on your life experience. What are the top three things that people might consider doing to be bulletproof in order to feel better, to have more energy, more power across any domain you've experienced?
Well, other than ye olde eat, sleep, exercise, I would say be very curious about where the science is headed, and be your own best advocate. Look at the hormone science. Listen to your doctor. Ask your doctor, should I take supplements? Should I be on hormone replacement therapy? Am I old enough for that? And if I should be, well, tell me the reasons why I should or shouldn't. And are you going to monitor me if I do take this? And if you're unwilling to take me on to do this, can you suggest someone who else might be willing to monitor me? Again, you're as healthy and as sort of progressive as your own mind and curiosity allows you to be.
I really like that. It makes great sense. And thank you for answering that. Now, can you tell our listeners where they can learn more about you? We will, of course, include links on the website and in the show notes. But for people listening, what's your URL and the name of your book again, and the other relevant contact info?
My book is The Doper Next Door, My Strange and Scandalous Year on Performance-Enhancing Drugs, published by Counterpoint. It's out in hardback. You can find it, of course, as an ebook as well. You can download it to any of the ebook technologies. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. And those are the best ways to find me.
Excellent. Andrew, this has been a fascinating interview. I really appreciate you taking the time to share your experiences and to talk about your book today. Have a great afternoon.
I really appreciate you having me on. Thank you so much.
If you enjoyed this, we totally appreciate a positive ranking on iTunes. If you want to learn more about biohacking, try following at Bulletproof Exec or just read our blog. And we really appreciate people who sign up for our email list so we can let you know about new things that are happening and just keep the news flowing.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.